Good morning, Your Honor. Chris Forsyth, registration 22608, here on behalf of appellant Brian Kilpatrick. This is a workers' compensation claim that involves a change of opinion by the treating physician. It's a hand injury, well, wrist injury to the left hand that the claimant suffered. And the treating physician placed claimant at MMI, maximum medical improvement, on June 27th. After that point, the claimant kept going to the doctor, surgery was recommended, and the treating physician changed his opinion after a surgeon recommended that an ulnar shortening be performed on the claimant. At that point in time, we asked the treating physician, are you changing your opinion? What's the status here of your opinion? The treating physician changed his opinion regarding maximum medical improvement. And that's where this litigation that's before you today began. The ALJ determined at hearing that the hindsight change of opinion by the treating physician is not a mistake, essentially as a matter of law. As a matter of law, the ALJ is incorrect. This court previously held in the Byrd case that a change of opinion by a physician due to more medical information is exactly what a mistake is. And that's what happened here. The treating physician got the report of Dr. David Connors, a respected hand surgeon, and the treating physician said, you know, if I had had this report, claimant would not have been placed at maximum medical improvement. And that's why he changed his opinion. That's a mistake under the Byrd case and under case law and under the statutes as well. Dr. Yamamoto was hesitant to call it a mistake in his testimony. That's understood. We're all hesitant to say we made a mistake. However, case law says that this was a mistake. In that regard, the ALJ erred and the ICAO erred in affirming the ALJ.
Well, if Dr. Yamamoto changed his mind, so now the ALJ was faced with conflicting MMI dates from the same ATP, under the Blue Mesa case, doesn't the ALJ have the authority to decide between conflicting ATP opinions as to the MMI? Or I'll put it another way, given the fact that Blue Mesa says that he does, why doesn't that apply here?
Because there wasn't a conflicting opinion. Does the ALJ have the right to determine? Yes, you're right. But we submit to you that there was no conflict here, because Dr. Yamamoto was clear, claimant was not at maximum medical improvement. He never said claimant was at maximum medical improvement. When it came to the deposition, to his testimony, he said claimant is not at maximum medical improvement. So there was no evidence in the record supporting that as of the day of that deposition that Dr. Yamamoto said claimant was at maximum medical improvement. So the ALJ erred at a minimum in saying that as of the date of that deposition, claimant was at maximum medical improvement. The sole issue before the ALJ was not, was the claimant at MMI on June 27, 2012? The issue before the ALJ was whether claimant was at maximum medical improvement at all, meaning on anything. The Dr. Yamamoto did rescind his prior determination of maximum medical improvement. He did go on to theorize that, well, it could be done as maintenance. The surgery could be done as maintenance. After the surgery, I could ascertain whether he was at maximum medical improvement, maybe not. But he never wavered that he did not believe claimant was at maximum medical improvement. The ALJ's findings in that regard are not supported by substantial evidence in the record.
Well, you just opened the question I was going to ask, actually, the employer's lawyer. Mm-hmm. The employer's doctor, whose name escapes me for the moment.
Sullender.
No, actually it was the H, I think. Oh, well, Landon.
Landon.
Said, oh, this surgery that you want to perform can be performed as medical maintenance. There doesn't have to be, as I understood what he was suggesting, there doesn't have to be a reopening case or a change of the MMI date. This can be medical maintenance. Maybe that's what's called rollover benefits. I'm not exactly sure the terminology. So why is this just a tempest in a teapot, a fight over something, over a procedure? Why can't the surgery that Dr. Conyers suggests that Mr. Kilpatrick needs be performed as a matter of medical maintenance so we could avoid this whole conflict about reopening the case?
Because I believe if you read the order, the ALJ found that the surgery was not reasonable and necessary. So there was a difference of opinion by the physicians whether the surgery was reasonable or necessary to begin with. And Dr. Conyers said that the surgery was reasonable and necessary. Dr. Yamamoto agreed. The paid experts for respondents disagreed.
That's Solander.
Solander and Lander disagreed that the... Well, maybe I'm incorrect. Maybe it's only Solander who said that the surgery was not reasonable or necessary. So in one regard, this case is different from some other cases for a work comp reason. There was no division IME in this case. If we had a division IME in this case, that completely changes the playing field. There was no division IME here. They did not seek a division IME. They chose to admit to the report of Dr. Yamamoto. When they did so, what that does leave open is this circumstance where the treating physician subsequently changes his opinion. That allows us to go back in and move to reopen the case on the basis of mistake just due to the change of opinion by the treating physician.
Excuse me, whose burden was it to request a dime?
Either party can request a dime once receiving the opinion of Dr. Yamamoto. Respondents chose not to request a dime by filing the final admission of liability. Then the claimant also has the option of requesting a division IME after receiving the final admission of liability.
And why was that not done?
Because at that time, Dr. Conyers' reports were not available. The treating physician had not changed his opinion regarding MMI. None of this had occurred. That's exactly what the Byrne case, which allows reopening, says reopening is supposed to be for. There's good language in that case regarding why cases are supposed to reopen, saying that the panel's interpretation, which is of the dive process in Burr, the panel tried to say that the claimant could not reopen because the division IME made the decision. This court ruled that the panel's interpretation elevates the goal of final resolution over the protected function of the reopening process. So we have a reopening process for this exact circumstance where additional things happen after defining maximum medical improvement that leads the physicians to a different opinion.
But it depends on a mistake having been made.
Right, but a change in opinion based on hindsight, mm-hmm. based on a new report.
Is defined as a mistake.
Is defined as a mistake according to the Byrd case. And that's what happened here with Dr. Yamamoto.
But Mr. Forsythe, even if what you say about the Byrd case is absolutely true, if, mm-hmm. as you also said, Dr. Yamamoto himself said, I don't know that I made a mistake, couldn't the ALJ rely on that statement by Dr. Yamamoto?
Dr. Yamamoto is not a lawyer. Dr. Yamamoto is a physician who obviously, you know, wants to avoid any potential malpractice issues, whatever, for using the word mistake. However, although he said that based, looking back, this hindsight, what the ALJ put in her order was hindsight. Looking back, had I had Dr. Conyers' opinion now, I would have made a different play in the game, was kind of how he said it. I wouldn't have placed claimant of maximum medical improvement. And he didn't vacillate on the fact that claimant was not currently in maximum medical improvement. So that's a mistake, no matter what Dr. Yamamoto wanted to call it. Under the law, under the Byrd case, that's a mistake.
The chief circumstances, as I understand it, is that in the intervening period, the claimant had an operation on his other wrist. He'd been in a motorcycle accident or something.
That's correct.
And the concern about whether he had psychological issues that precluded the surgery seemed to be alleviated by the fact that he successfully survived the surgery on his other wrist. That's part of what changed, I think, Dr. Yamamoto's, Dr. Thompson. Was there testimony that explained that those were the basis of the change circumstances? Can I get out of your brief? I'm not trying to get out of it. ALJ's opinion or the testimony.
Dr. Yamamoto explained, I'm not sure whether it was in his reports or in his testimony, that I believe it was in his deposition testimony, that there was, he did make a change based on claimant's mental state. that he wasn't in a proper mental state at the time he was placed at maximum medical improvement. Indeed, that was one of the basis for reopening, and that was addressed by the ICAO below. And they said there wasn't, well, it was up to the ALJ, and the ALJ said it wasn't sufficient. But yes, the treating physician did state that the claimant's, Mr. Kilpatrick's, mental state was a part of the change of opinion. There's only 5 minutes left at this point. I'm going to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Forsyth.
May it please the court. I'm Harvey Flewelling, registration 22605, and I represent Goodwill Industries of Denver and Pinnacle Assurance. Based on the initial part of the opening argument, it appears to me that the claimant basically is requesting the court to reweigh the evidence and substitute its judgment for the factual findings of the ALJ. That is an improper appellate review that the claimant is asking for. Mr. Forsythe pointed out this Byrd case, which involved a reopening where a physician basically changed his mind based on a mistaken diagnosis. But under the Blue Mesa Forest case, as Judge Richmond pointed out, the ALJ has jurisdiction and the obligation to resolve conflicts in the treating physician's opinions. And if those, if the resolution of those conflicts is supported by the evidence, then they must be affirmed. And here, there's ample evidentiary support that Dr. Yamamoto vacillated in his opinions and his testimony regarding whether a mistake was made. And that's the, as Mr. Forsythe pointed out, the issue here is whether the claimant is entitled to a reopening of his case on the basis of error, mistake, or a change of condition.
And well, counsel, how do you respond to your learned colleague's contention that there was no evidence from Dr. Yamamoto that claimant was at MMI?
There's ample evidence. I totally disagree with that. Dr. Yamamoto issued reports. The June 27, 2012 report, there's evidence that he placed claimant at MMI, gave the claimant an impairment rating, and the insurance company filed a final admission of liability. And at that point, if the claimant wanted to challenge that MMI determination, he should have requested a division IME, which he did not do. That's why the case closed. So then it comes down to whether the claimant can prove a worsening condition or an error mistake that would justify reopening, which is within the discretion of the ALJ. As pointed out in my brief and throughout the orders by the ALJ and the ICAO, Dr. Yamamoto vacillated in his testimony, stating he didn't make a mistake. And also, as Judge Richmond pointed out, Judge Richmond pointed out that Dr. Landon testified that the proposed surgery could be done as medical maintenance. Dr. Yamamoto also testified that that could be the case as well.
What does the employer say about that? Can it?
I mean, if it's been known to happen, but in this case, other physicians, Dr. Solander and Dr. Landon, have reported and testified that this proposed surgery is not reasonable and necessary. There was a lot of controversy regarding whether the claimant was ulnar negative or ulnar positive. Mm-hmm. That was the difference of opinion between Dr. Conyers and Dr. Solander and Dr. Landon, and I believe Dr. Rorvik or another surgeon in this case, that all reviewed MRI reports and x-rays. And the majority of the physicians who reviewed these tests determined that the first surgery that was performed initially, and which the insurer paid for, reduced the length of
the ulna,
and any further reduction could actually create more harm than good.
Do you agree with Mr. Forsythe that under the Byrd case, changed circumstances is equal to a mistake? And justify, and allows for reopening?
I would, in the, I disagree in, as far as, I think you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. The Berg case involved a mistake in diagnosis.
Right.
So whether the, I mean, it's up to the ALJ to make a fact-finding whether a mistake was made that would justify reopening.
Here you have, arguably, you have a changed circumstance here, whether Yamamoto said it or not, and I think he did say it. The changed circumstance was, in the interim, this guy had had another surgery. And the psychological barrier that he was suffering from more surgery that they were concerned about seemed not to be as valid as they originally thought in June or whatever year it was that the MMI was found.
Well, certainly, the psychological, the psychological condition was an issue throughout this, and maybe the fact that he had surgery on his other wrist, but in fact, he had surgery on his left wrist originally as well.
Mm-hmm.
That was an issue. That was a, there was a dispute regarding that. And Dr. Yamamoto certainly at one time said he believed that claimant was now psychologically able to undergo the surgery. But Dr. Conyers, even in his testimony, subsequently testified that he would still have to clear the claimant psychologically before he would go forward with the surgery. So that still was an issue that was up in the air, as far as I know, up until today. The psychological issue does not affect whether physically the ulna needed to be further repaired by surgery, and whether such surgery was reasonable and necessary.
And the doctors can't agree on that. There's a disagreement among the
doctors. There was disagreement, and the judge decided to credit the respondent's witnesses that it was not reasonable and necessary. There were many other issues argued in the briefs, and in particular the equal protection argument raised by Mr. Forsythe. I want to point out, it was pointed out in the brief that in the Youngs case, this argument had been rejected. And Youngs also pointed out, one of the arguments that Craig is making here is that there's a failure, there's a lack of equal protection because workers' compensation judges are not subject to making public financial disclosures. As pointed out in the Youngs case, there was an executive order by Governor Owens in 2001 that made workers' comp and other administrative judges subject to the Code of Judicial Conduct. The Code of Judicial Conduct, it's section 3.15A2, specifically requires judges to make public financial disclosures, including gifts from certain parties. So that argument that there's basically a twofold argument the claimant makes. Number one, that he needed discovery as to financial ties that judges had with Pinnacle. And there was no other way but discovery to obtain this information. Well, you have the Code of Judicial Conduct that requires judges to divulge such information.
So, I'm surprised by your response, Mr. Flewelling. Is there some place that we could look to find financial disclosures then made by ALJs in workers' comp cases and members of the panel?
No, I'm not aware of where to look for that.
But am I understanding you correctly to say that your understanding of that executive order or directive is that ALJs and workers' comp cases and panel members are required to provide financial disclosures just as judges are?
Based on my reading on the Youngs case, a panel of this court cited that executive order in its published decision and cited, I think it was section, or I may be wrong on the side of the section, but
I'm not sure that in the Youngs case actually decided this issue about financial disclosures. There are two opinions in the Youngs case, and the first one, as I read it, was unpublished and didn't refer to this issue, but the second opinion said it had been discussed in the first opinion, and therefore it wasn't going to address it on the basis of issue preclusion.
That was part of it, Your Honor. That was part of the decision in the published case.
Right.
At page 975, it's 297 P second, 964, page 975, the court states, Executive Order D-00801 expressly provides that all administrative law judges shall adhere to the Colorado Code of Judicial Conduct to ensure that Colorado's administrative justice system provides efficient, fair resolution to disputes and matters, including but not limited to workers' compensation. And if you look at the CJC, Rule 3.15A2 does require judges to make public financial disclosures. Where you find that, I'm not sure.
Okay, I'm but just that. Surprised to hear you say that, yeah. Because I don't think you said that in your brief. And
I didn't. I was actually rereading the case at about 6 a.m. this morning and came across that. Now, I did say in my answer brief, that the Young's case had addressed the issue of the equal protection, and I didn't specifically mention the Code of Judicial Conduct, and I apologize for that.
Would you agree that if in any given case an ALJ has received a contribution or something of value from an employer who's the respondent, that the ALJ shouldn't sit on the case?
If it comes within the confines of Code of Judicial Conduct, right. I would agree with that statement.
Would you agree that the claimant in a particular case ought to know or is the right to know that an ALJ has received financial gift or contribution or benefit from a particular employer in that case?
Can't think of a reason why I could disagree with you on that.
So if the questions that Mr. Forsythe propounds in these interrogatories are so overbroadly objective or narrower, you might not object to those interrogatories.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's a point I wanted to make was the pre-hearing judge found that the question or the interrogatory was unduly broad or burdensome. And I think there was a problem with the fact that it was crafted in such a way. I think it affected any Pinnacle employee's relationship for the past 5 years. And the claimant didn't make an attempt to narrow that interrogatory or any other attempt for discovery on that issue to narrow it down and make it less burdensome. And that was a matter for the pre-hearing judge's discretion.
Mr. Fulon, while you're looking at your papers, let me ask you another question about the equal protection issue. You said in your argument, in your brief rather, that the rational basis for not requiring financial disclosure by ALJs and panel members is that that would promote the streamlined and efficient decision making in the workers' comp system. How would that be done?
As far as streamlining, less discovery regarding that sort of information.
If ALJs were required, or as you say, they are required to disclose their financial mm-hmm. contributions, I'm not sure how that would provide for a more streamlined and efficient workers' comp system, because as we are required to make financial disclosures, we do so annually, and if it slows us down, I don't think it does so to an appreciable extent.
Yeah, I believe I was probably quoting one of the cases that I cited, either the Young's case or the Abbiato case, potentially.
Right, there was case that said that the streamlined efficiency of the workers' comp system would be promoted by having ALJs to decide workers' comp matters, but that seems to me to be different from the issue of requiring financial disclosure by ALJs and panel members.
It may be slightly different, but I believe that was the argument that had been made in the Young's case. That was part of the argument that financial disclosures need to be made, and also distinguishing between executive department judges and judicial department judges. But the point I want to make with regard to that is the claim has not shown that there's disparate treatment to similarly situated individuals. If he's comparing himself to litigants at the district court level, there's not been a showing that a workers' compensation claimant is similarly situated. I would submit that they're not similarly situated, and I think the court in Young's and Aviato and possibly other cases make that distinction, that they are not similarly situated individuals. And that's claimant's burden to show that this is this practice or is unconstitutional, and that, I submit, has not been shown. There's no other questions. I would request that you affirm the decision of the Industrial Claim Appeals.
Well, thank you, Mr. Fulani.
In regards to the equal protection argument, we put forth in the brief that the right to a fair and impartial hearing is a fundamental right. That brings a strict scrutiny standard to this case as opposed to a rational basis.
Mr. Forsythe, what is your response to what Mr. Fluelling just said, that according to his understanding, workers' comp ALJs and panel members are already required to make financial disclosures?
I completely disagree. I've been surprised twice. I was the attorney on the Young's case he's referring to, and I've been surprised twice now with this executive order. It was never ordered. It was never argued in Young's case. It was put in the order by the judge.
Pardon me, how can you be surprised twice?
Because the executive order wasn't brought up in this case either.
Yes, but you knew about it from the Young's case, so it can't be a surprise now, can it?
Well, it wasn't argued in his brief at all. Okay. The executive order exists. It's a nicety. There is absolutely no enforcement of that provision.
I don't know that there's any enforcement of the provision with respect to us either, but we are required to do it, and we do it. We file it with the Secretary of State's office.
Exactly.
So couldn't you get this information from the Secretary of State's office for the ALJs?
No, it's not there. They do not file public financial disclosures with the Secretary of State. And yes, I know, I can give it on all of you with the Secretary of State. You send them an email, they shoot you the reports, the annual reports the judges make. You cannot get that information on administrative law judges. There is no provision in the law that requires administrative law judges to make financial disclosures to the Secretary of State.
So do you know where they do make their disclosures?
They don't make any disclosures.
So, Mr. Forsythe, to your knowledge, is that executive order that Mr. Fluelling referred to still in effect?
Well, there's a dual. Practically, I don't. Well, pragmatically, I don't think it's being enforced. It's a nicety. Is it still in effect? I don't know of any governor who has rescinded that executive order.
It seems that if it's still in effect, then the issue, your equal protection issue, may have been changed in nature to the issue of enforcement to the issue of from the issue of constitutionality of the financial disclosure statute.
Well, 24.6.202 requires that all public officials, judges, make public financial disclosures, and those are filed with the Secretary of State. We have no public financial disclosures for administrative law judges.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and I hear what Mr. Fluelling is saying also, but it appears to me that based upon what the two of you are saying, that the issue may be lack of enforcement, and that ALJs and panel members should be submitting financial disclosures to someone, whether it's the Secretary of State or someone else, I'm not really sure. Does that make sense to you?
Again, I wasn't prepared for this. Rule 3. Whatever, he says, of the Code of Judicial Conduct, does not phrase financial disclosures in the same terminology that CRS 246201 does. CRS 246202 requires the reports and the annual follow-ups. I believe the rule of judicial conduct that he's pertaining to, and I object because I did not notice this, but I believe the rule is much more general. It doesn't require public financial disclosures on an annual basis to the Secretary of State where we can check on those. But the real basis is here, I requested the information in discovery. We shouldn't have to get to the equal protection argument. It should have been answered in discovery. Instead, it was objected to as irrelevant. And then the pre-hearing judge said it was overburdensome. The fact that it was overburdensome, why? Because they're giving so many gifts, they don't have the time to go back and recount them all? The ALJ's ruling gave an incredible appearance of impropriety in this matter by saying that that was overburdensome. We shouldn't have had to ask those questions. And I'm out of time here. I thank you for your attention to this order, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Forsythe. Thank you again, Mr. Flewellyn. We appreciate both of your fine arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.